This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. And yes, by the time you hear this, England might be in a World Cup final. They might not. The women's pod will be out very soon. Listen to that. In the meantime, the VAR big club conspiracy is real. Onana flattens a very large Wolves player, but nobody sees it. Demoted referees, Wolves robbed, people getting the chance again to say, the thing is, the technology is run by human beings. Again, wonderful stuff. And at the end of it all, a scratchy winning start for Manchester United. While we're on United, we'll discuss Mason Greenwood's future and then on to Chelsea. Caicedo arrives, taking Todd Bowley's spending to over £900 million. A great chance for us to discuss amortisation again. If there's one transfer I'd like to hear Philippe discuss, it's Neymar's move from PSG to the Saudi League. And if time, we'll ask you for some likes and positive reviews and give you more vasectomy content. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, bonjour, ça va, Philippe Auclair.
Ça va très bien, Max. Good day to you.
Good day to you. Will Unwin, hello.
Hello, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Bonjour.
Let's start at Old Trafford. Monday night football. Manchester United beat Wolves 1-0. Rafa Varane's header with 15 minutes to go. Will, you were there. Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, I just want to be open and honest and praise the work of the referee and VAR because if a penalty was given, my rewrite 2 minutes to deadline would have been absolutely atrocious. Whereas in the end, my first runner was just very average. What a funny decision it was for the penalty. Let's be honest. I think the interesting thing about the demotion of the referee and the VAR official is I feel quite sorry for Simon Hooper. It's one of those challenges that in real time it doesn't look too bad. I don't understand why the referee's being criticised. He's got the backup now of the video assistant. And he wasn't sent to the screen to look at it. It was just an assistant in his little box watching it at Stockley Park said, no, that's not a penalty. He's the one massively in the wrong. I think there's a problem with refereeing at the moment due to VAR that they're very cautious. And so even if he thought it was a penalty, we'd just err on the side of caution because it's injury time at Old Trafford. Let's be honest, he doesn't want to make a headline for himself. So he's like, well, I'm going to put it in the hands of the people that can look at it a few times because to me, it could be either way. But it was definitely a penalty. And it's a shame for Wolves on every level because it's not like it would have been smash and grab. They deserved to win that match. They were the far better team, absolutely running the show. Mateus Cunha looked like a new man. And after 4 days with Gary O'Neill, I think we all need 4 days with Gary O'Neill to revitalise ourselves. They were really good. They had a plan, they had a strategy. They just can't finish, which was the problem, one of their problems last year. They scored 31 in 38, and you could see why. Whereas Manchester United have got far more problems than Wolves, judging by the opening day, because they had no midfield. Mason Mount and Bruno Fernandes next to each other didn't seem to work, and Wolves just ran through them with ease. And Manchester United should be mildly embarrassed that they won in the end.
On that penalty, Baz, I mean, I know it shouldn't matter, but does the fact that Wolves players didn't all surround the referee, and I don't want to encourage that, but I just feel like they didn't complain enough, because I guess he was just completely flattened. Kalajdzic, who's he's a hard man to flatten, I imagine. He's quite big. But they didn't really... One guy, I can't remember who wasn't quite in the referee's eye line, was just like, that is obviously a penalty.
Well, I think there must be something in the water in officialdom HQ, because, I mean, there was a mildly similar thing yesterday where... any rugby fans among our listenership will have seen Owen Farrell get sent off against Wales on at the weekend for one of his trademark high non-tackle tackles. He's got a rap sheet the length of his arm. He the English RFU employed an expensive barrister, went to a tribunal or an inquiry of sorts, not only didn't get him a short ban, but actually got his red card overturned, which was quite simply remarkable. And this decision was remarkable. I don't want to see players surrounding the referee and appealing either. And in it, where a case is that clear-cut, they shouldn't have to. I mean, it was quite obviously a penalty. And it just beggars belief that whatever about the ref, the VAR guys didn't award one.
Are you saying, Barry, there should be barristers in the VAR room, maybe, as well? When they cut to Stockley Park, someone in a big wig.
Well, no.
Varistas,
in
then.
In this case...
Yeah, varistas, yeah, exactly.
If the ref had awarded a penalty, then, you know, a team of men with horsehair wigs and with briefcases would have, you know, marched out onto the pitch and they'd have surrounded the referee. It was just an astonishing decision. The one thing I would take issue with, possibly with what Will said, isn't the decision ultimately the referees? Like, VAR doesn't make decisions, VAR advises. So if the ref wants to go and have another look at it, he is perfectly entitled to do so. But he clearly just chose not to.
But surely he's advised by the people that can see it. So if he's on the pitch and he's got someone in his ear and they've given him no reason to go see it, and that's, you know, if he's not given it in the first place, he's not really going to overrule the people that have looked at a number of replays. I can't see where the logic with that would be. The referee has the final decision. He's the one with the whistle and points to the spot. But yeah, once he's spoken to Mr. Salisbury, you know, you've got to back your man who's got the replays when all he's seen is a split second.
Once he's spoken to Kavanagh QC, who said...
Rumpole of the Bailey.
Rumpole says, it's not a clear and obvious error, Milad. Yes, Philippe?
I've got a question, because I watched the game in France, and on the feed we had, when the incident happened, there were two in pictures, within the picture, showing the same... the incident at real speed, slow motion, several times, and they were basically intimating this is what VAR is looking at the moment. And the commentators and, you know, the analysts were saying, well, clearly it's a penalty, so Wolves are going to get a chance to draw level, and nothing happened. And I was wondering, was it the same in England? Did they show the images that were being played in the VAR headquarters? And also, is there any audio recording of the exchange between Salisbury and Hooper? Because that would only be the only reason why I think Hooper should be penalised for that. So there are two questions. Tell me, please.
Well, Barry's the only one I presume can answer that, because I was in midair with a toddler for 24 hours and Will was at the game. So I don't know, Barry, what the Monday Night Football people said.
I don't remember, to be honest. But didn't Howard Webb, who's sort of the referee boss, didn't he say last season that he was going to start publicising bits of audio to help us plebs, you know, see the process and hear the process and have a better understanding of how it works? This would be a very good time to start.
Well, they did do that, didn't they? He did, and it was really revealing, actually, but they chose lots of incidents that they got right and a couple of difficult ones that they got wrong. So we're yet to hear the audio of like a calamitous error. But look, as Will says, Barry, Wolves were so much better in this game. And Matthias Cunha, he was almost like, you know, it was like the bigger boy at school. He was just so dominant in this game.
Yeah, away from the farcical refereeing decision, Wolves, I was astonished. I wasn't sure what to expect for them. I thought Bournemouth did well under O'Neill last season, but they were quite boring, but this was a very swashbuckling front foot performance, and Manchester United seemed helpless in the face of just the same attack over and over and over and over again, whether it was Matthias Cunha or Matheus Nunes, who were just galloping through the middle of the pitch from one penalty box to the other and then playing the ball out wide to Sarabia or whoever, and then the crosses were coming in. And if Wolves were better able to finish their chances, they could have won this game by five or six goals. But as Will says, finishing has long been a problem for them, and it doesn't look like things are about to improve anytime soon.
I mean, it sort of looked like they were getting barged off the ball a lot. They looked slower and just didn't look as fit as Wolves United.
No, that was probably the most surprising thing, that that Wolves would be a fitter outfit and perhaps more more direct in the way they challenge the opposition. You know, we could expect that from a Gary O'Neill side, but I think probably, I mean, Will, you were there, but and you probably felt that even more than we did in front of our screens, but it seems like every single 50-50 or even 40-60 ball was going Wolves' way. That they were sluggish in possession, that when, and be it, by the way, the ball on the floor or an aerial duel or actually any situation in which you had two players or three players vying for the same ball. Similarly, the contrast between the speed of transitions in that Wolves team when they had the ball, which was actually one reason why perhaps Wolves fans should actually draw a lot of belief from that. I mean, I thought some of the football they played was absolutely exquisite and incredibly direct. And it was just not just Nunes and Cunha, but also Ait Nouri had a terrific game. But the contrast between that directness and sometimes imagination and risk-taking from the Wolves side, which you would never have expected, marked out the sluggishness, the slowness, the lack of imagination, the lack of penetration. I mean, it's the lack of from that Manchester United side. It's absolutely extraordinary, to be honest, obviously, because this is this was such a poor performance that obviously we've got to draw the conclusion that Manchester United are not going to win anything this year or in the next 10 years to come. But yeah, I think for Erik ten Hag, the fact that you get 3 points from that, and you know it's only going to get better, certainly in terms of performance, but it was really, 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 really poor. I mean, I haven't seen much of United in the build-up and the friendlies, but was there anything to suggest that they would be so behind schedule, sluggish?
One thing Ten Hag said before was this is the fittest the team would be.
Wow.
So, which is an incredible statement.
Well, I think in pre-season, Manchester United had two different teams travelling around playing various games, so maybe they should just field the other one next time out.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right. We draw all our conclusions from one game and therefore Man United are completely screwed. But it was sort of, I couldn't work out what the plan was. Or maybe they just thought it's Wolves, they're having a bad time, this will be easy. And like even 5% of complacency at this level is actually has a big impact, because actually all these footballers are quite good at it.
The interesting thing about United, I think, Wan-Bissaka was probably the one that came out with a bit of credit. He was the one winning those 50-50 challenges. But the makeup of that midfield, I think, has got massive problems. I can't see how they're going to continue with Fernandes and Mount as the two in front of Casemiro. And obviously, idle speculation, but Casemiro, you know, the other side of 30, had a very good first season, but I suspect the most difficult physically he's seen for quite a long time. And if he's having to suffer as he did on Monday night, it's going to be an even longer season for him. And they don't have an obvious replacement. And so you've got Martinez, who had to be taken off at half time because he had an awful time. Anyone in the final third was basically a passenger. So they're going to have to get bodies in that they're looking at, especially in midfield. I think Amadou and Arna's been linked, Amrabat. And they're going to have to change the makeup of that midfield. Otherwise, they're going to struggle in quite a few games.
I like the idea of them crossing to Jeff Shreves, going, and there was that half-time change there, Jeff, what's happened? And he just goes, yeah, oh, Lisandro Martinez was just having an awful time. Just wasn't enjoying it. So he's decided not to come back on.
I don't think it was Jeff Shreves, Max. I think he's left the building.
No. But, no, he has left. Yes, I still think Jeff is still the generic go-to. Maybe Patrick Davison. I'd go with one of those. Maybe Des Kelly. You know, I was using the generic sense. Onto a slightly more serious subject. I've read there were protests against Mason Greenwood at Old Trafford, Will, about whether he's reintegrated into the squad. I mean, were there or and if they were, sort of how big were they?
There was two protests before the match, which was one was anti-Glazer and one was Greenwood, regarding Greenwood, and they're in the same place, so judging who was there for what was quite difficult. It wasn't as big as some of the protests I've seen, but very vocal, you know, lots of placards and obviously lots of strong feeling, and rightly so. Inside the ground, it was more anti-Glazer than I saw with Greenwood. And it was obviously, there's a sort of very vocal section at United in certain part of the stadium, which is, you know, where most of the banners are regarding the Glazers and things like that. I didn't personally see a Greenwood banner, not with, you know, not without a set of binoculars. But yeah, there were plenty of banners before the match, which make people making their voices heard. And you know, and obviously it was a week where they've delayed the decision again, having United being quite vocal, saying that it will be done before the season. Clearly it wasn't, for whatever reason in the background. So United have come out of the week looking quite bad, just because they were very bolshy that if this investigation would be done and sorted and the end result would be confirmed. But yeah, it was an interesting one. Obviously, you ended up with the Wolves fans doing the sort of chants you may expect in these circumstances without me wanting to repeat them. It was an interesting one. And I'm sure if the United keep dragging the decision out, there'll be more protests before the next game.
Just to remind people, he was arrested in January 2022. In October of that year, was charged with attempted rape, controlling and coercive behaviour, and assault occasioning actual bodily harm. He denied all the charges. They were dropped after key witnesses, quote, withdrew their cooperation from the investigation, according to the CPS. Anyone who has followed that story will have seen posts by his girlfriend and perhaps heard the audio that she shared that's alleged to be Mason Greenwood. There were reports, Jamie Jackson had reported, that Manchester United delayed announcing their decision because they wanted to consult key stakeholders, which included three of the England women's team who were about to play a World Cup semi-final in an hour's time. The Athletic now reports that United will inform their women's team of the decision and seek feedback, but their opinion will not dictate the outcome of the investigation. I mean, it seems to me, Barry, ridiculous that they have not resolved this yet.
Yes, it's been a long time, and the longer they drag out the decision, the more it seems to be apparent that they really want to keep Mason Greenwood and reintegrate him into the squad and play him, but they're terrified of any potential reaction from people who don't think he should be reintegrated into the squad. Jonathan Liu wrote a very powerful column about this that's on the website. I think it went up yesterday or the day before. And I was surprised, actually. The reaction on Twitter was, where you have what Johnny described as depraved Mason Greenwood fanboys, was largely, the reaction seemed to be from people who think he shouldn't be reintegrated into the squad and that there shouldn't be a place for him at Manchester United. But as it's ultimately going to be dictated by the bottom line, isn't it? The benefits of keeping, the financial benefits of keeping Greenwood outweigh any negativity that keeping him would generate.
Right, I'm just taking my hazmat suit, and because this is my goodness, how do you talk about this? You start by talking about it by wondering if it is actually the right thing to talk about it. Then there are all the dimensions. I mean, there's the financial dimension, obviously, which is going to play a role in United's decision, but I don't think such a huge role, despite the fact that his wages, I believe, are around £100,000 a week, which is no small amount of money. But even then, there's a sporting dimension, which is the fact that he was by far the best finisher at the club. But would he ever be able to play again at Old Trafford or in the Premier League? I genuinely don't think so. I think it would be totally impossible for him to do so. There's the ethical minefield. And there's especially, and I think this is how it's going to be resolved one way or another, it's a legal question. It's the letter of the law, I think, which would dictate what they decide to do. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's taking them so bloody long, because you don't want to be in a situation where you have a player who is the subject of some of the, you know, most disgraceful allegations that you can, and accusations rather than allegations that you can think of, and who suddenly turns to you and starts suing you for unfair dismissal. If he's not found guilty in a court of law, how can you justify breaking his contract? And I would imagine that they're going round and round. You've got this, all these dimensions are put together, and it's an impossible mess. And I think that, which is why I try usually not to talk too much about it, because it's very easy to cast stones at people and to say, well, United should have done this, or United should have done that. Yeah, okay, hold on a minute. How can they do it? Can they legally do it? Financially, the financial dimension, we should all agree, we should forget about that. This is, you know, neither here nor there. But legally speaking, it's a kind of Gordian knot. And at some point, somebody will have to be Alexander and take a sword and cut it. And this is going to be a risky one. And whichever decision is taken, believe me, there will be consequences, pretty bad consequences for Manchester United. But though I have to say, again, perhaps we're losing view of the fact that perhaps the person we should have the most sympathy for is the person who is not talked about and who was the victim of the alleged attacks. And we tend to forget about this when we start to talk about the bigger picture. And sometimes the bigger picture is not the most important picture.
Mm. Absolutely right. And it's always important when you're listening to these to realize that we have to be very careful about what we can and can't say on all these stories, and how when you talk about one story, it's what's very difficult. And I wrote a piece about sexual violence and domestic violence and football's attitude to it. And I actually had to write the piece without mentioning any specifics of any case. Otherwise, there was no way that it was going to get published. So that kind of highlights the difficulty of it. And football's, and what it means is, we rarely, but we do sometimes, but lots of people don't go anywhere near the discussion of football's relationship with domestic violence and sexual violence. And it is something that needs to be talked about. It's just really, really, really hard to do it. But as Barry said, Johnny Liu wrote a brilliant piece about it, and it is really worth going to find that. That'll do for part one. We'll be back in just a second.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We're live on tour in November, starting in London at the Troxy on the 13th of November, 14th of November in Bristol, 15th in Manchester, 20th and 21st in Dublin, 22nd in Brighton. Will, you've promised us an anecdote in Manchester, the Will Unwin anecdote on the 15th. This is going to be, we are going to build this up. We're going to put all the production money that we have will go into a huge musical intro to the Will Unwin anecdote.
Happy to take it nationwide.
Great. Oh, well, that's a big shout. Well, why not? Philippe, you're coming to London? You're staying in London?
Yes, I am.
Excellent news.
Oh, yes. I'll bring my guitar along as well.
We want your guitar and what you really think about FIFA. And we want people to come. TheGuardian.com/FWTour23. Come along, please. Tickets are selling pleasantly quickly, so get in, because you'd hate to miss out. You know, a bit like how upset my wife is about not being able to get to see Coldplay on this tour, Barry. There's no way.
What?
I know.
Why can't
Philippe.
You see them?
I don't know. Very hard to get a ticket. They're you know, they only played Perth in Australia. We weren't there. We were in Europe, and then we've got a small child. It's quite hard to sort all these things.
But you've got an old pair, Max.
I don't have an au pair. Martine did 2 hours a day while I was on my own. Au pair is...
So you weren't on your own. You had an au pair.
I did 22 hours a day, 22/7. And that's enough hours for me to feel like, you know, I did a good job. Anyway, Moses Caicedo has signed for Chelsea in a deal potentially worth $115 million from Brighton. Contract running until 2031. As producer Joel writes, Phil, so far in the future, he'd be probably going to training in a flying car, which Marty McFly did in 2015 in Back to the Future 2. It was quite a sweet Twitter video of him, you know, with his mum, I presume it's his mum, sitting on the boot of the open boot of the car in a Chelsea shirt when he was young. So perhaps he just, Barry just always wanted to go to Chelsea and not Liverpool.
Maybe. I'm beginning to wonder if Liverpool are perhaps losing their appeal, and my younger players, you know, we're old men.
It's harsh on Will, isn't it? But I don't know.
35.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, old enough.
Yeah, he's an old
younger man. Than James Milner. It's fine.
You know, if I'd been a good young footballer and Liverpool wanted me, that's probably the only place I'd want to go. But maybe they're not as attractive to younger players anymore. Don't seem to be able to offer the same good terms as Chelsea. Liverpool really seem to have messed up their transfer policy. They've had, you know, it's well documented, they've had three different sporting directors in recent times. The current one's only on a short-term deal, so he'll soon have to be replaced. After missing out in Casado, they wanted to go for Romeo Lavia, but he's also going to Chelsea. Does that speak of a dearth of ambition on his part? Whereas, you know, he'd probably be guaranteed more playing time at Liverpool because it's not like Chelsea are in Europe this season, so they'll be playing fewer matches in Liverpool, there'll be fewer opportunities. Maybe he just backs himself to be better and to force his way into the Chelsea team. But yeah, Moyes Caicedo is an excellent signing for them. And obviously people are wondering how Chelsea can make all those signings and not fall foul of financial fair play. I don't know if someone wants to explain it. I can try. It's important but boring, as Philippe said before we started recording. So I'll leave it to Philippe to do that.
Well, let's go to Philippe. His hand is raised. As Charlie says, given Chelsea seem to have proven that FFP isn't a thing, should Gillingham go in for Mbappe and allow him to live his dream of hearing his name being sung from the Rainham end? So it's about amortization, Philippe, isn't it? I think most people, it's a word football fans have now heard and think, I wish I hadn't heard it, but still.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, first thing is that, I mean, most importantly, Chelsea are not in Europe, so they do not have to abide by the rules of the UEFA financial fair play. That's the first thing. But they do have to abide by the rules of the Premier League financial fair play. And the Premier League has not yet followed UEFA's suit in deciding that you could not offer a contract over a period of which were more than 5 years. So England, you can still do 7, 8, 9 years contract if you want to. So this allows you to split the purchase price of a player between the number of seasons, as we all know now, that the player is supposed to be at the club. So in the case of Moises Caicedo, he might have cost £115 million in total, but it will only cost Chelsea £14.3 million a year. That's the way you've got to think of it. And the same goes for Mudryk and all these players, and Fernandez, all these players they've signed on these massively long contracts. So when you put all this together, it's not as huge a sum as you think, even if in total we're close to £800 million in total over the duration of the contracts. But on the other hand, what happens is that obviously when you sell players, and Chelsea have sold quite a few, especially this summer, you're able to claim most, if not all, of the value, because there's also amortization here. So I'll take an example. If you sell Mason Mount and Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who are club products, basically they cost £0, you can offset the whole value of their transfer to Manchester United in this case. And well, I've forgotten for Loftus-Cheek, but so that's 75 million quid that you can offset. So, you know, you can get a few Caicedos for that. Then you've got the case of somebody like Kai Havertz. Kai Havertz cost £71 million. He had 2 years left on his contract, so you do the calculation, and you realize that his value on the book was only £28 million. Then you sell him for £61 million to Arsenal, and then you realize, well, you've made a profit. It will show as a profit of £36.8 million. So because of that, you're able to balance the books. I agree with you. It's bullshit.
Is that never ending? Or does that not sort of eventually come back and you have a big hole?
No, I mean, it's at the end of the five-year contract, the player is worth absolutely nothing in the books. Zero. That's the way it works. It is insane. The whole thing is insane.
And Chelsea also, they don't have a shirt sponsor yet. They don't have a shirt sleeve sponsor yet. So that's more money that can come in and, you know, help balance the books. They have an academy which churns out talented players which they can sell on. You know, they don't necessarily ever have to have made an appearance for the club, but other clubs will want to buy them and that further boosts profit. But I'm wondering, Philippe, what happens, say, if you buy someone like Moyes Caicedo, give him an 8-year contract and he just stinks the place out and is useless, you know, just doesn't perform. And we've seen that happen with various normally strikers going to Chelsea, you're stuck with him and you're not going to be able to sell him for a profit. You're only going to be able to sell him at a huge, huge loss. And considering how many transfers don't work out, the odds suggest that quite a few of the players they've signed for big money on long contracts will not end up being successes.
So, yeah, for example, if it really was an awful year for Caicedo, which I don't think will be the case, but just for the sake of the argument, and they decided, okay, we're going to sell him, they would have, his value would have been diminished by 14.3 million. So he would only be worth 100 million pounds. So you can imagine, yes, if they sold him for 20 million, they would have made a loss of 80 million. So that's the way it works.
I hate to bring this onto the pitch, Will. Far be it for us to actually talk about how this might work for Chelsea on the pitch. But what is it? Fernandes, Caicedo and Lavia? Is that a three? Is that what they do?
I'd be surprised if that's the starting three. But, you know, you can juggle things now. You can have fun. They'll probably sign another defensive midfielder before the end of the window for 60 million quid.
They spent over 900 million and they really... I mean, Jackson did play, I thought, played quite well. But I don't know if his... You know, is he the only number nine? And Nkunku, is he a nine? Like, they don't seem to be like a complete squad, which you'd hope you'd manage to fashion for £1 billion.
Yeah, Nkunku is likely to play down the middle, I'd estimate, when he is fit, but he's, it looks like he's going to be out for a while. Probably means, up again, just go buy a new striker somewhere. Lukaku's still knocking about, you know, if they can find him, get him out for a few games. I reckon on his contract, he's going to go for a huge loss now.
Well, do you have any recollection, actually, Max and Barry as well, of a big club, really big club, European champion just a couple of years ago, who is going to start the season with an 11 in which there's going to be perhaps one or two players from the previous editions and all the rest are going to be new players? I mean, I cannot think of a club where there's been as much turnover. Not even the Chelsea of Abramovich when he started. There was some kind of transition from Ranieri to Mourinho and then second Mourinho season. So even same thing at Manchester City when they were taken on by the Thai guy. Then they moved on to the Emirates. But this is incredible. It's like getting rid of absolutely everything and everybody and starting anew.
But I think there's a variety of reasons for this. Obviously, the general feeling that some of it was a bit stale. You've gone through a few managers in a very short period of time, but interestingly, they've hired a lot of new recruitment people, and those recruitment people will have a very stats-based model, and they're finding those players that fit into the systems that Pochettino wants to play. To
like Thiago Silva.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's still there with his base contract value of roughly sort of £1 million, I suspect. But this is it, and they're going for what Pochettino wants, and they'll have their own systems of stats looking at Pochettino's previous teams of when they were at their best, you know, and performing at their optimum, what they needed style-wise to improve on, say, what they had at PSG, what he had at Spurs, to get the best out of those roles within the team. And to do that, you basically have to sign a completely new squad and hope that as a system it works over the next 5 years, which is an interesting one in football because it's generally quite a short-term concept. But they know who they want at, you know, right back, centre midfield, to fill those roles. And say they wanted Caicedo for £115 million because they know he's the best in that role. And if you want the second best person in that role, you go for Romeo Lavia, who's at £60 million. And that's it. They're signing a new squad to fit everything within Pochettino's tactics and statistically, you know, who's doing those roles the best. And this is what a massive recruitment team does. And if they've in theory got the money to do it, then they're going to go out and do it. And they're going to say that Mason Mount doesn't fit into what Pochettino does. So he can go, Loftus-Cheek can go, et cetera, et cetera. And that Lukaku can, you know, sit around the training ground until we find a bid because he's not going to fit in regardless. So we signed two new strikers to play that role. And yeah, it's God, capitalism's fun.
It's also a very young squad, isn't it? And I think if I remember correctly, and one of you might pull me up and say that Southampton under Pochettino, which is sort of when he first came to our attention, had Franny Benali, Jason Dodd and Matt Letizia in the side. But I think that was also a very young team, wasn't it? And he did well with them. I'm terrified now I've got this completely wrong.
Pochettino at Southampton. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I'm guessing James Ward-Prowse was there. but he might not have been. I can't remember. It was so. No, he probably wasn't, was he?
Ricky Lambert.
Was Ricky Lambert there? That's perhaps where Ricky Lambert learnt his.
Graziano Pelle.
Graziano Pelle. Yeah, that's good. I don't know, Barry, but bound that if it's wrong, someone will tell us and then we have some content for tomorrow's pod. So that's ideal. Neymar going to Saudi Arabian club Al Hilal in a move up to, worth up to £86 million. Neymar PSG Saudi Arabia has to be a full house on Philippe Auclair bingo.
Oh, my God.
Oh, which we God. Will play at the live show in London. Give everyone a bingo card. Oh, that's fun, isn't it?
it's one of those that you really couldn't say, I never saw that coming. I think we all saw that one coming from a long, long way. Even though a Qatari club selling one of their biggest players ever, because he was, to a Saudi Arabian club shows that things have changed diplomatically quite a bit over the past few years. They wanted to get rid of him. And I have to say that some PSG supporters I've spoken to are actually quite sad to see him go, because you could get the impression that all of PSG's problems over the past few seasons have been linked to the fact that Neymar was Neymar. But in fact, the problem was not that Neymar was Neymar. The problem was that Neymar was injured, because when he was around, he was actually their best player very often. And very often he was the only player there who was showing actually some commitment to the side when they had become a clown car and everybody was laughing at them. It makes sense for them to sell him, in as much like Chelsea, to make a bold comparison. They are planning a kind of reboot of the whole club and the squad and the team and so forth with Luis Enrique, and he's surplus to requirements. Now, Messi's gone. Neymar, the problem is his fitness. You know that he's only going to be with you for about half the season. And then what do you do with him? The idea that he could go back to Barcelona, I think, is not something that could be entertained. And then suddenly there was this opening of selling him for a massive amount of money for a 31-year-old. They took it. And that's another superstar going to Saudi Arabia. And it's actually only these are the headline makers, because they carry on. Apparently, Clément Lenglet is also joining a Saudi Arabian club. So it's now starting to look like what I think I've always believed it would be. It's not a Chinese Super League kind of thing. It's not an NASL kind of thing. It's a big thing which intends to completely shake up the whole world order in terms of football. And I think stands a good chance of doing that in the longer term. I told producer Joel that just before, I mean, when we were talking about this pod, I mentioned the fact that after I watched United Wolves on French television, guess what was the game that was broadcast live on the biggest football channel? It was a game from the Saudi Arabian League. They have just reached a deal for showing three games per week plus highlights for the next 2 years. At the same time, the Saudi Pro League has also signed a deal with DAZN, or DAZN, depends how you say it, for the UK, Austria and Germany. So you're going to see Saudi Arabian football regularly on DAZN in the UK. And this is not something that the Chinese Super League did. They are putting in place not just the teams, they've bought the clubs, as we know now, the four clubs which have been nationalized, bringing the players in with the kind of arguments that nobody can possibly better in terms of financial terms. What they're doing as well is that they're getting into the media rights circus. They're purchasing companies, creating companies, which are all subservient to PIF, by the way. Anybody who still thinks that Neymar going to Saudi Arabia is just a sign that he's a washed-out player who is joining a competition, which is a kind of a vanity project of Mohammed bin Salman, is totally deluded. It's yet another cog in the wheel. It's yet another wave on this surf, non-stop crashing on the European beaches, and which will become a very, very big actor indeed within just 2-3 years, I believe, and which will has in view the idea of an expanded World Cup, which Club World Cup, which we will have from 2024 onwards, in which Saudi clubs, which no doubt will wipe the slate clean, you know, and wipe all the opposition in the Asian competitions, they will be taking part in that and will start beating big European sides.
As the podcast Moral Compass, can I ask, is it all right for me to be extremely uncomfortable with, say, the Saudis taking over Newcastle, but to think it's fine for them to develop their own league however they see fit?
I think you have a very strong point here, a very valid point in some ways, because first of all, it's not as if the current regime is the initiator of the current Saudi league. It's been in place for a long time. It's actually been a very competitive league for a very long time. It's one of the best league in the Asian Confederation. It has been for a very long time as well. What is happening is that it's changing its nature, and this is where we can have problems, because it is now being weaponized. And I think you can. There is, on one hand, the problem with, well, they're actually promoting the regime in England, and they're also using England and English football to varnish their image and to present a face of Saudi Arabia, which is simply not true. It's pure. It's a propaganda tool. You can think about that. But on the other hand, if they do it at home, it's their absolute right to do so. You know, it's their right to do so. But the problem is that they're weaponizing that. It's not as if suddenly there was this great, I was going to use the word crusade, as if this was this intent to make the Saudi Football League become even better, an enlightened project. That's not that. It's actually completely cynical manipulation, completely cynical weaponization by a sovereign state, by an autocracy, to use football to further its aims, be they diplomatic or in terms of propaganda, image, whatever. So yes, you should feel also very uneasy about that, but perhaps not quite to the extent that we feel uneasy about what's happening in Newcastle. It's never black or white here. It's different shades of grey. And I think that grey is very, very dark in Newcastle. And it's still dark in Saudi Arabia, but not quite perhaps as close to black as the other.
We're very quick to criticise Newcastle. Should we criticise, say, Liverpool because they sold Jordan Henderson to a Saudi club? Do they get a free pass?
Yeah, they do. Chelsea have come across some criticism when they sold quite a few players to Saudi clubs. Well, Fabinho is another one, by the way. But you could say that, you know, all they could do is that they received an offer. Were they going to make a grandstand, you know, and say, no, we're never going to deal with these people. This is not going to happen. And the player wanted to go, quite obviously.
What about Tottenham agreed a fee, I think, with Spartak Moscow. Was it Spartak Moscow? For Davinson Sanchez, I think he's gone. You know, the same weekend that they were doing a game for Ukraine, or a game against Shakhtar Donetsk, where Shakhtar was getting the money. Do we judge Tottenham for selling to Russia?
I think there actually, I should look into that, because I think there's a problem with the sanctions there.
He didn't want to go, but just the principle of it. I also, I love it. I was just do a pod where we just ask, you know, Philippe questions about our lives. And it's really like, because I don't like decisions. I like being told how to feel. It's just a nice, me and Barry finding out what we should feel about everything from Philippe. Fascinating stuff. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do any other business.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Yeah, so by the time you've heard this, England will or won't be in the World Cup final, as will the Matildas, to our Australian listeners, of which I know there are many, playing Spain. Susie Rack's going to join us on tomorrow's pod to talk about that. The Daily Telegraph newspaper in Sydney sent up an aeroplane to capture images from the Lionesses' behind-closed-doors session at their training base, published under the headline, 11 Poms Against a Nation, Welcome to the Jungle, Lionesses. As I said, we'll have Susie on tomorrow to talk about it on the subject of the Women's World Cup. Our friend Samindra Kunti, who joined us for that Pele pod that we did after he passed away, tweeted that New Zealand refused Gianni Infantino a police escort during the tournament and said the FIFA president threw a tantrum. I know you've done a lot of talking, Philippe, but I can only come to you for this news.
Oh, I couldn't possibly say how delighted I am by this. Oh, blah. Yeah, sorry.
I don't know where the evidence of the tantrum is. We saw, you know, the quote saying New Zealand police received the request.
Sam is a very fine journalist. Yeah. I'm sure he will have at least three independent sources who all witnessed the tantrum of Gianni Infantino.
Well, I wish we were there.
I would love to see that, an Infantino tantrum.
Barry, do you know where Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain is?
Besiktas.
Correct. Well done. We really thought that was the most did you know who X is playing for now, Barry, transfer of the window.
No, I knew it was Turkey. I just wasn't sure which club.
Jeff says, evening, Max. Cambridge fan on 606 was demanding greater coverage of the U's. See, happens to every club. Why not? Why, you know, you never talk about us. Will you be top of the league by the time the pod goes out? If so, what chance of a quick we are top of the league? I said, we are top of the league. Well, no, because we lost at home to Stevenage. And our season is suddenly over. That's how we had a good ride while it lasted.
As soon as you leave the country, they lose, exactly. Max. Yeah. Maybe you need to come back.
Well, I will one day. And, you know, the glory days can return. And he says, dear Max, Barry and company, my son and I have been loyal listeners of Football Weekly since the AC Jimbo era, whatever that is. In fact, being from the US, this podcast is responsible for almost everything I know about English football, which probably explains why I'm so bad at Fantasy Premier League. This Saturday, August the 19th, my son Ryan is getting married to a wonderful woman named Samantha, and I'm over the moon for both of them. I was hoping that Barry would be able to provide his usual brand of wedding best wishes, though perhaps with less emphasis on the disastrous outcomes of the majority of matrimonial unions that he usually provides. I know this would mean a lot to Ryan. I would greatly appreciate it as well. Thank you for all you do. Cheers to all of you. That's Andy. So that's Ryan and Samantha. Do your best, Baz.
Well, I'd like to wish Ryan and Samantha every happiness, and I'll leave it up to Andy. When he's... Do fathers of the groom give a speech or is it just the bride? I think sometimes fathers of the groom do. But yeah, I can leave it up to him to give the prognosis at the reception, I suppose. I've never been to an American wedding, so I don't know if they're any good or not. I've only sort of seen them on rom-coms and they tend to work out well, but...
I mean, if it is a rom-com, there'll be some jeopardy, won't there? It can't all just be good and then, yeah, so, you know. But normally that sort of, it culminates in the wedding.
Hopefully the celebrant will be Ted Danson and dressed, you know, wearing prosthetics and a 100-year-old mad vicar. What was that? Three men and a baby?
Friend of the pod, Chris O'Dowd, will be there somewhere, presumably.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Maybe Barry could run in and stop the wedding. Maybe
is there any reason?
This is the role.
Barry says, yeah, that's a good idea. Do you have feelings for Samantha, Barry, or not?
I'm sure Samantha's a lovely woman, but okay. I'll be honest. If Samantha was even remotely interested, I don't know if she's a fan of the podcast, but if she is even remotely interested, I'm available.
So, it would make the next email we get from the family interesting, wouldn't it? That's all we'll say. But on the off chance, that Samantha stays with Ryan, we wish you all the very best. It doesn't run off with Baz. We wish you the very best. Simon says, not a question, just a comment. Some really poor advertising placement for a children's storytelling box on a podcast mainly listened to by men who've had vasectomies. It's a good point. I mean, does mean they've also have children. A different Andy saying, after hearing last pod about the vasectomy distractor and Barry asking if it was a thing, I can confirm, having had said procedure, there is someone else there who only seems to start up conversation whenever the surgeon is about to do something. In my case, it was a woman in her early 20s who was telling me about her upcoming holiday. You may not be aware, but during the procedure, they numb one side and work on that ball, then numb the other side to work on the other ball. Someone told me the reason, I don't remember why. I presume you don't get them numbed at the same time. But actually, I'm not a doctor.
Our friend of the pod, Barca Jim, a few years ago, he gave up his daily grind job to become a funeral celebrant and a stand-up comedian. And I believe he is thriving in both pursuits. And I think vasectomy distractor sort of is right in the middle ground. He'd have the necessary gravitas for the solemnity of the occasion and the procedure while having enough, you know, jolly gags in his quiver to lighten the mood. So maybe he could take that on as a third job.
I think I'd like, you know, you're right. You don't need to be, it's not the person doing the vasectomy. I'd like that to be a specialist job, not somebody who like just, it's like a handyman. Like that's really pure focus. This is the only thing I do.
Yellow wire or the red wire.
Yeah, I'm doing some, I put up some shelves. You don't get it on Airtasker. It says I can do any job. I can pick up your cardboard and I can do this. Anyway, Andy continues. As she was telling me about her holiday, the doctor drifted to the non-numb side. Now, I didn't want to scream or swear in this woman's face, so I decided to contain the noise. This meant she told me she was going away with a few of her girlfriends, and I responded with a low guttural growl, which made me look like a pervert with my my balls literally hanging out. Moral of the story is just scream or swear. Keep up the good work. Go football. Thank you very much, Andy. And I've been asked by producer Joel to ask people to leave reviews for the podcast. I mean, it sounds so desperate, Barry, that I'm reluctant to ask people to review it. But apparently it's an important, we need to do it. So I'm presuming if you listen regularly.
Leave reviews where, Max? Like on pub toilet on walls?
I think on the podcast, we probably haven't had a review since like 2016. So it could sort of update them a bit like my pick on the Guardian website needs updating. But yes, if you could go and, I'm not going to say give us 5 stars and say you love it. Be really honest. Apart from that person you sent the other day, said this podcast needs to, what is it? What do we need to do?
Figure out what we are.
Yeah, figure out what we're trying to do. I mean, presumably you get the idea from the conversation that you've just heard over the last hour. So anyway, if you'd like to leave us a review, great. Give us whatever you want. And if you don't, you don't have to. Like, don't feel obliged. In the meantime, that'll do for today. Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you very much.
The Will Unwin anecdote coming to Manchester in November 2023. Thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
We'll be back tomorrow. Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.